This is the Pearson Edexcel International GCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2, Listening Test, November 2023. This test is in four parts, and you'll have to answer questions on what you hear. At the end of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people advise teenagers on how to save money. Read the list of advice below, then listen to the extracts. For questions 1 to 5, identify which piece of advice, A to H, is being described by each speaker by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box, and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all advice is described, and each piece of advice may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 2 minutes
to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions. Speaker 1.
Have a day when you decide not to spend any money. It may sound simple, but it can be more difficult than you think. You probably spend cash on at least one thing every day. However, with a little planning, you can take this down to zero. You will be surprised how the money saved will grow.
Speaker 2.
If you live at home, your parents take care of necessary expenses, like food and your education. However, you can keep a note of how much money you receive, and how much you spend on things like going out or getting the latest computer game. Once you have done that, think about how you can limit your spending.
Speaker 3.
Even if you have only a small amount of money left over each month, it is a good idea to save it in a bank account. There are advantages in doing that. Firstly, it prevents you from spending carelessly. And secondly, most accounts give interest. This means that the money in your account is increasing, slowly earning you extra income.
Speaker 4. The average teenager will spend £46 a month subscribing to various apps, some of which they hardly ever use. Check if you are spending money on a music or TV streaming program you no longer need. You may have an app you no longer use, but which is using up money from your account. It is time to cancel unused subscriptions. Speaker 5.
Working during your holidays can be a great way to earn extra income. It also looks good on your college application form. There are many opportunities for students to earn extra money during the summer, working in shops, restaurants, or cafes. If you are willing and hard-working, many employers will offer you a part-time job when you return to school or college.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Speaker 1.
Have a day when you decide not to spend any money. It may sound simple, but it can be more difficult than you think. You probably spend cash on at least one thing every day. However, with a little planning, you can take this down to zero. You will be surprised how the money saved will grow.
Speaker 2.
If you live at home, your parents take care of necessary expenses, like food and your education. However, you can keep a note of how much money you receive, and how much you spend on things like going out or getting the latest computer game. Once you have done that, think about how you can limit your spending.
Speaker 3.
Even if you have only a small amount of money left over each month, it is a good idea to save it in a bank account. There are advantages in doing that. Firstly, it prevents you from spending carelessly. And secondly, most accounts give interest. This means that the money in your account is increasing, slowly earning you extra income.
Speaker 4. The average teenager will spend £46 a month subscribing to various apps, some of which they hardly ever use. Check if you are spending money on a music or TV streaming program you no longer need. You may have an app you no longer use, but which is using up money from your account. It is time to cancel unused subscriptions. Speaker 5.
Working during your holidays can be a great way to earn extra income. It also looks good on your college application form. There are many opportunities for students to earn extra money during the summer, working in shops, restaurants, or cafes. If you are willing and hardworking, many employers will offer you a part-time job when you return to school or college.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear some advice on how to earn money. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 2 minutes
to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hi, and welcome to my podcast about how to earn money. This month, I would like to give you a few hints about how to make money from your unwanted clothes. If your wardrobe is full of outfits that you rarely wear, or you've decided it's time to part with a few old favourites, why not cash in on the growing demand for pre-loved clothes and sell them? Do you have clothes you have never worn, taking up space in your wardrobe? Then you are not alone. It's estimated that over our lifetimes, we spend £22,000 on unworn clothes. With a little planning, you can declutter your space, shrink your wardrobe, and earn some cash by selling your unwanted clothes online. An original 1960s dress or a brightly coloured 1970s shirt could be a must-have item for a new generation. It is easy to sell items, as there are many different sites for different styles of clothes. There are online sites that specialise in vintage or designer clothes and accessories. Others just buy in bulk old jeans and t-shirts. If you do not have the time or patience to do the work yourself, there are online services that will, for a fee, sell items for you. It also means that you do not have to store the unwanted clothes until someone else buys them. You can order a selling kit with the people you have chosen to do business with, fill the bag, and post it. You'll receive money for your items when they are sold. If you are not ready to let go of your precious items, why not rent them out for special occasions? There are online companies that will help you to do just that. You could rent out your designer dress or suit for as long as your customer needs it. The company will then see to it that your items will come back professionally cleaned. For more money earning and saving tips, why not sign up to my free weekly newsletter?
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hi, and welcome to my podcast about how to earn money. This month, I would like to give you a few hints about how to make money from your unwanted clothes. If your wardrobe is full of outfits that you rarely wear, or you've decided it's time to part with a few old favourites, why not cash in on the growing demand for pre-loved clothes and sell them? Do you have clothes you have never worn, taking up space in your wardrobe? Then you are not alone. It's estimated that over our lifetimes, we spend £22,000 on unworn clothes. With a little planning, you can declutter your space, shrink your wardrobe, and earn some cash by selling your unwanted clothes online. An original 1960s dress or a brightly coloured 1970s shirt could be a must-have item for a new generation. It is easy to sell items, as there are many different sites for different styles of clothes. There are online sites that specialise in vintage or designer clothes and accessories. Others just buy in bulk old jeans and t-shirts. If you do not have the time or patience to do the work yourself, there are online services that will, for a fee, sell items for you. It also means that you do not have to store the unwanted clothes until someone else buys them. You can order a selling kit with the people you have chosen to do business with, fill the bag, and post it. You'll receive money for your items when they are sold. If you are not ready to let go of your precious items, why not rent them out for special occasions? There are online companies that will help you to do just that. You could rent out your designer dress or suit for as long as your customer needs it. The company will then see to it that your items will come back professionally cleaned. For more money earning and saving tips, why not sign up to my free weekly newsletter?
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear advice about how to make your shopping greener. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box. And then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 2 minutes
to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hi, I'm Emily Martin, Chief Editor of the programme Greener Living. I'm on a mission to help you, our listeners, make greener choices when you shop. As you all know, sustainability, which is a way of protecting the environment, is considered to be very important at the moment. It's such a big topic that we can be forgiven for thinking that it's too big a problem for us to deal with. That's the reason why, in today's programme, I want to look at simple changes we can all make to help tackle the problem of deforestation across the globe. In our recent survey, well over half of you told us that the destruction of rainforests is one of the environmental issues you are most worried about. Clearing the forests affects not only climate change, but the lives of many people, animals, and plants that live there. According to environmental scientists, one of the biggest changes we can all make is to reduce our consumption of meat and dairy products. That's because 90% of the soya that Britain imports comes from countries such as Brazil and Argentina, where forests are cleared to grow soya in increasing quantities. It's a cheap way to feed the animals, which produce the meat we consume. As a society, we've become dependent on cheap meat. But it need not be like that at all. If you wish to continue eating meat, grass-fed meat is a better option. This means the animals eat mostly grass, although some of their diet may contain soya. Consider organically farmed meat. In many cases, the animals are fed on grass only. Organic meat is much more expensive, and therefore you might have to buy much less of it to fit into your family budget. However, organic meat is so much better in taste. There's less waste. You don't need to eat as much of it. Your diet can be supplemented with organically grown vegetables, fruit, and pulses. People are gradually becoming more aware about eating less meat. Meatless Mondays and vegan months have become popular moves towards encouraging us, in Britain, to eat less meat. When you buy coffee or chocolate, look for the certification logo with the little frog and the words People and Nature on it. It comes from the Rainforest Alliance, an organisation linked to protecting the environment. Having this logo means that the products, such as coffee and chocolate, have been grown in a way that does not contribute to deforestation. You can try to avoid buying products that contain unsustainable palm oil. Most of us know that palm oil, which is found in food items ranging from bread to ice cream, has been linked to deforestation in many countries in Southeast Asia. You could switch to palm oil-free products or look for those that contain certified sustainable palm oil. The packaging of these products will display a green logo of a palm tree. Whether you want to avoid unsustainable palm oil, tackle food waste, or buy products with a lower carbon footprint, there are apps on the market, which are usually free, that can help you. By scanning the barcode of a product when you shop, you can see how ethical, sustainable, or healthy it is. If the product scores badly, then the app will give you an alternative. Day-to-day changes in our habits can, over time, have a great impact on the health of our planet. For example, in Britain, since a charge of 5 pence was introduced for plastic bags about 10 years ago, the number of them washed up on Britain's beaches has fallen by 55%. Indeed, it's time to make small changes that make a big impact.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hi, I'm Emily Martin, Chief Editor of the programme Greener Living. I'm on a mission to help you, our listeners, make greener choices when you shop. As you all know, sustainability, which is a way of protecting the environment, is considered to be very important at the moment. It's such a big topic that we can be forgiven for thinking that it's too big a problem for us to deal with. That's the reason why, in today's programme, I want to look at simple changes we can all make to help tackle the problem of deforestation across the globe. In our recent survey, well over half of you told us that the destruction of rainforests is one of the environmental issues you are most worried about. Clearing the forests affects not only climate change, but the lives of many people, animals, and plants that live there. According to environmental scientists, one of the biggest changes we can all make is to reduce our consumption of meat and dairy products. That's because 90% of the soya that Britain imports comes from countries such as Brazil and Argentina, where forests are cleared to grow soya in increasing quantities. It's a cheap way to feed the animals, which produce the meat we consume. As a society, we've become dependent on cheap meat, but it need not be like that at all. If you wish to continue eating meat, grass-fed meat is a better option. This means the animals eat mostly grass, although some of their diet may contain soya. Consider organically farmed meat. In many cases, the animals are fed on grass only. Organic meat is much more expensive, and therefore you might have to buy much less of it to fit into your family budget. However, organic meat is so much better in taste. There's less waste. You don't need to eat as much of it. Your diet can be supplemented with organically grown vegetables, fruit, and pulses. People are gradually becoming more aware about eating less meat. Meatless Mondays and vegan months have become popular moves towards encouraging us, in Britain, to eat less meat. When you buy coffee or chocolate, look for the certification logo with the little frog and the words "People and Nature" on it. It comes from the Rainforest Alliance, an organisation linked to protecting the environment. Having this logo means that the products, such as coffee and chocolate, have been grown in a way that does not contribute to deforestation. You can try to avoid buying products that contain unsustainable palm oil. Most of us know that palm oil, which is found in food items ranging from bread to ice cream, has been linked to deforestation in many countries in Southeast Asia. You could switch to palm oil-free products or look for those that contain certified sustainable palm oil. The packaging of these products will display a green logo of a palm tree. Whether you want to avoid unsustainable palm oil, tackle food waste, or buy products with a lower carbon footprint, there are apps on the market, which are usually free, that can help you. By scanning the barcode of a product when you shop, you can see how ethical, sustainable, or healthy it is. If the product scores badly, then the app will give you an alternative. Day-to-day changes in our habits can, over time, have a great impact on the health of our planet. For example, in Britain, since a charge of 5 pence was introduced for plastic bags about 10 years ago, the number of them washed up on Britain's beaches has fallen by 55%. Indeed, it's time to make small changes that make a big impact.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an interview with a television celebrity and author. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box, and then mark the new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 2 minutes
to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Welcome to Radio Book Club. Today it's my pleasure to introduce someone who, thanks to his novel, has become a household name. He is best known as the host of popular quiz programmes, but now has won thousands of new fans with his novel The Thursday Murder Club. Richard Osman, welcome and congratulations on your novel becoming the number one bestseller.
Thank you. I still can't quite believe all the attention my novel is receiving. Not bad, I tell myself, for a first book.
For years, you've been a successful television producer, working not only behind the scenes, but also presenting some very successful shows. Your face is familiar to lots of people. Now you're famous, how does it feel to be recognised and stopped in the street by people who want to congratulate you?
Because I'm really tall and wear thick, dark-rimmed glasses, I think I'm used to people staring at me in the street. Ever since I was a teenager, I've been stared at as I walk into a restaurant, go to the cinema, or get on a bus. So it's quite nice to think people stare at me now because I'm on television and they recognise me.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners are keen to hear how you got to write this mystery novel. Where did you get your inspiration from? The world of television must be a million miles away from a story about four pensioners who decide to investigate the mysterious disappearance of a very unpopular character.
No, not really. I've always been interested in mystery stories, and I had various ideas going around in my head for writing one. It was visiting my mum and her friends who live in a beautiful, quiet village that made me think, hang on, this would be a perfect setting for a mystery. And the people whom I've just met, like my mum's friends, would be the perfect people to solve it.
But why did you decide to have a group of elderly people solving the mystery and even outwitting the police? Not the most obvious of heroes, people who have retired and no longer work. You must have found it difficult creating personalities for characters who are in their 70s.
No, not at all. I spoke to many older people and listened to some of the amazing things they've done in their careers. In Britain, we're obsessed by young people, but those in their 70s have identical brains to those who are much younger. As we get older, our circumstances become different, and we change physically, but we gain a great deal of experience, and I think that we remain as fun-loving, mischievous, and interested in life as we've always been. In fact, I found it very easy to get into the mindset of a 70-something retired lady.
I can see that, and I quite agree with you that older people are often dismissed in our society, which is such a great shame. So, tell me, how did you start? It's all very well having great ideas, but you're a busy man with a number of television programmes on the go. Did you have a routine you kept to?
Yeah. At first, I actually set myself the discipline of writing every day for a month, just to see how I'd cope with both writing and my television work. By the time I had written 10,000 words, I couldn't stop myself. The book became a part of my daily routine.
Yeah. Do you still write every day, now that you're writing a sequel? How long do you write each day?
Well, I find I can't write for more than 2 hours a day. And some days, I find I can't write at all. I only get down to it when I've run out of all other options and excuses. I try to write a whole chapter, about 1,000 words, each time, as that gives me a sense of completion. When people say how great they think the short chapters in the book are, they don't realise it's only because I've got a short attention span.
I think you're being a bit hard on yourself. It's challenging to stay focused. So I would have thought that publishing a book is not that different from producing a television programme.
Oh, you must be joking. Having the book published was the most nerve-wracking experience I've had for a long time. My book was the thing I'd put most of my work into. It was simply a part of me.
I've heard that there's talk of a film. Is that true? Have you any suggestions or ideas of who you'd like as your main characters?
Well, I've been told I can have a say in who I'd like in the film. There are so many incredible actors, but I don't want to be drawn into any discussion about it. And every reader would want to see their favourite actor taking one of the main parts.
Yeah, I've got my perfect cast as well. And what about you having a small role in the film?
Somehow, I don't think so. Given that I'm very tall and wear these glasses, I think it'd be weird if I had a role. I'm just so recognisable. A small role should have the viewer guessing, was it or wasn't it Richard? They would recognise me immediately.
Fair point. Thanks, Richard, for coming on the show. We're all looking forward to the sequel.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking about something that I really loved writing, and I'm proud of it.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Welcome to Radio Book Club. Today it's my pleasure to introduce someone who, thanks to his novel, has become a household name. He is best known as the host of popular quiz programmes, but now has won thousands of new fans with his novel The Thursday Murder Club. Richard Osman, welcome and congratulations on your novel becoming the number one bestseller.
Thank you. I still can't quite believe all the attention my novel is receiving. Not bad, I tell myself, for a first book.
For years, you've been a successful television producer, working not only behind the scenes, but also presenting some very successful shows. Your face is familiar to lots of people. Now you're famous. How does it feel to be recognised and stopped in the street by people who want to congratulate you?
Because I'm really tall and wear thick, dark-rimmed glasses, I think I'm used to people staring at me in the street. Ever since I was a teenager, I've been stared at as I walk into a restaurant, go to the cinema, or get on a bus. So it's quite nice to think people stare at me now because I'm on television and they recognise me.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners are keen to hear how you got to write this mystery novel. Where did you get your inspiration from? The world of television must be a million miles away from a story about four pensioners who decide to investigate the mysterious disappearance of a very unpopular character.
No, not really. I've always been interested in mystery stories, and I had various ideas going around in my head for writing one. It was visiting my mum and her friends who live in a beautiful, quiet village that made me think, hang on, this would be a perfect setting for a mystery, and the people whom I've just met, like my mum's friends, would be the perfect people to solve it.
But why did you decide to have a group of elderly people solving the mystery and even outwitting the police? Not the most obvious of heroes, people who have retired and no longer work. You must have found it difficult creating personalities for characters who are in their 70s.
No, not at all. I spoke to many older people and listened to some of the amazing things they've done in their careers. In Britain, we're obsessed by young people, but those in their 70s have identical brains to those who are much younger. As we get older, our circumstances become different, and we change physically, but we gain a great deal of experience. And I think that we remain as fun-loving, mischievous, and interested in life as we've always been. In fact, I found it very easy to get into the mindset of a 70-something retired lady.
I can see that, and I quite agree with you that older people are often dismissed in our society, which is such a great shame. So tell me, how did you start? It's all very well having great ideas, but you're a busy man with a number of television programmes on the go. Did you have a routine you kept to?
At first I actually set myself the discipline of writing every day for a month, just to see how I'd cope with both writing and my television work. By the time I had written 10,000 words, I couldn't stop myself. The book became a part of my daily routine.
Do you still write every day, now that you're writing a sequel? How long do you write each day?
I find I can't write for more than 2 hours a day. And some days, I find I can't write at all. I only get down to it when I've run out of all other options and excuses. I try to write a whole chapter, about 1,000 words, each time, as that gives me a sense of completion. When people say how great they think the short chapters in the book are, they don't realise it's only because I've got a short attention span.
I think you're being a bit hard on yourself. It's challenging to stay focused. So I would have thought that publishing a book is not that different from producing a television programme.
Oh, you must be joking. Having the book published was the most nerve-wracking experience I've had for a long time. My book was the thing I'd put most of my work into. It was simply a part of me.
I've heard that there's talk of a film. Is that true? Have you any suggestions or ideas of who you'd like as your main characters?
Well, I've been told I can have a say in who I'd like in the film. There are so many incredible actors.
but I don't want to be drawn into any discussion about it. And every reader would want to see their favourite actor taking one of the main parts.
Yeah, I've got my perfect cast as well. And what about you having a small role in the film?
Somehow, I don't think so. Given that I'm very tall and wear these glasses, I think it'd be weird if I had a role. I'm just so recognisable. A small role should have the viewer guessing, was it or wasn't it Richard? They would recognise me immediately.
Ah, fair point. Thanks, Richard, for coming on the show. We're all looking forward to the sequel.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking about something that I really loved writing, and I'm proud of it. That's the end of part three. Now turn to part four. Part four. In this part, you will hear an extract from a science podcast on a problem in outer space. For questions 31 to 33 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than three words for each answer. For questions 34 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer.
You have 2 minutes
to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
If housework seems like a nightmare, be grateful you are not involved in cleaning up in space beyond Earth's orbit. Nowadays, we are increasingly aware of the importance of keeping Earth clean and our oceans plastic-free. However, there is one part of our universe that has been worrying scientists for a long time. As rubbish dumps go, there's nothing quite like Earth's orbit. The amount of rubbish, or space debris, since the first satellite was launched in 1957, is growing. Large and small pieces of satellites and other man-made objects remain in space long after they have ceased to be functional. there are over 17,000 objects orbiting the zone closest to Earth that are large enough to be tracked and catalogued by scientists. Many more are too small to track, but are just as dangerous. Only 7% of what is in space are functioning satellites. It's easy to work out that there is a growing risk. The satellites we rely on, from weather warning systems and environmental monitoring to satellite TV and mobile phones, could be seriously damaged if they collide with space debris. At the tremendous speed satellites travel, a collision, even with a small piece of debris, not much bigger than a ping pong ball, can cause a lot of damage. Space debris, rather than clogging up waterways or landfill sites like earthly litter, moves very quickly and has the potential to crash into working spacecraft along with their crews. Add to these thousands of frozen bits of still radioactive nuclear waste from disused radar satellites, and a disaster is waiting to happen. The only way to prevent the situation from deteriorating is to have a clean-up on an enormous scale. So how will the international community go about this outer space clean-up? As with all cleaning and tidying up, it's best to start with the largest objects, such as satellites, and get them safely out of the way of further collisions. The key to removing the rubbish is to lower its orbit so that it re-enters Earth's atmosphere, burning up as it does so. Just over 10 years ago, in one of the first experiments, a disused satellite was brought down, but no fragments of it were ever found. The satellite totally burned up on entering Earth's atmosphere. An international team of space scientists has spent years working on a project to construct a special rubbish-clearing craft that could be launched into space and then would latch onto disused satellites and destroy them. A prototype was constructed, and on a morning in March 2021, at 6 a.m, a Soyuz rocket was launched from Kazakhstan, carrying on board a small satellite no bigger than a washing machine and weighing 175 kilograms. It was thickly insulated with gold to withstand extreme heat and cold. The extraterrestrial rubbish collector had four cameras, radars, and lasers that would work out the speed, direction, and rotation of any disused satellite it would encounter. Finally, it was equipped with magnets that would capture the stray piece of debris. Having caught the piece of rubbish, the rubbish collector would then fly back with it to the edge of Earth's atmosphere, where they would both be burned up on re-entry. Scientists believe that humankind took one small but significant step towards the first extraterrestrial rubbish collection service. While this was just the first satellite of its kind and was only able to destroy one piece of rubbish, scientists hope that within 10 years they will have built a version that can capture up to four large pieces of debris at a time, drop them off in Earth's atmosphere to burn up, and then go back to pick up some more. Once the satellite has done all that it is programmed to do, it will self-destruct. The cost of such an operation could be met by satellite firms serious about cleaning up space, or by national space agencies and governments. Every country that has a space agency that launches satellites should be responsible for clearing up their own debris. An international space organization has been specially created to try to solve the problem of rubbish in space. It is an advisory group that has been working with space agencies to find ways to safely bring down satellites at the end of their lives, so they do not present a threat to other functioning spacecraft which are currently in orbit. People from outside the scientific community are becoming aware of rubbish in space. The majority of people who rely on satellites for services like mobile phones or internet money transfers have no idea that the technology they depend on in modern life may not be able to continue in its present form. The problem of rubbish in space must be addressed urgently. Scientists agree that, like any environmental issue, if the problem of rubbish in space is ignored, it could get much worse. It would reach a point where finding a remedy would be much more difficult and expensive than simply preventing the problem from getting out of control. One leading scientist compared not removing satellites in space once they have stopped working to leaving cars that have broken down and left abandoned on the motorway, expecting other cars to just swerve round them. It is also like people crossing a very busy road, where there are no pedestrian lights to regulate the traffic, and having to dodge the cars.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
If housework seems like a nightmare, be grateful you are not involved in cleaning up in space beyond Earth's orbit. Nowadays, we are increasingly aware of the importance of keeping Earth clean and our oceans plastic-free. However, there is one part of our universe that has been worrying scientists for a long time. As rubbish dumps go, there's nothing quite like Earth's orbit. The amount of rubbish, or space debris, since the first satellite was launched in 1957, is growing. Large and small pieces of satellites and other man-made objects remain in space long after they have ceased to be functional. There are over 17,000 objects orbiting the zone closest to Earth that are large enough to be tracked and catalogued by scientists. Many more are too small to track, but are just as dangerous. Only 7% of what is in space are functioning satellites. It's easy to work out that there is a growing risk. The satellites we rely on, from weather warning systems and environmental monitoring to satellite TV and mobile phones, could be seriously damaged if they collide with space debris. At the tremendous speed satellites travel, a collision, even with a small piece of debris, not much bigger than a ping pong ball, can cause a lot of damage. Space debris, rather than clogging up waterways or landfill sites like earthly litter, moves very quickly and has the potential to crash into working spacecraft along with their crews. Add to these thousands of frozen bits of still radioactive nuclear waste from disused radar satellites, and a disaster is waiting to happen. The only way to prevent the situation from deteriorating is to have a clean-up on an enormous scale. So how will the international community go about this outer space clean-up? As with all cleaning and tidying up, it's best to start with the largest objects, such as satellites, and get them safely out of the way of further collisions. The key to removing the rubbish is to lower its orbit so that it re-enters Earth's atmosphere, burning up as it does so. Just over 10 years ago, in one of the first experiments, a disused satellite was brought down, but no fragments of it were ever found. The satellite totally burned up on entering Earth's atmosphere. An international team of space scientists has spent years working on a project to construct a special rubbish-clearing craft that could be launched into space and then would latch onto disused satellites and destroy them. A prototype was constructed. And on a morning in March 2021, at 6 a.m, a Soyuz rocket was launched from Kazakhstan, carrying on board a small satellite no bigger than a washing machine and weighing 175 kilograms. It was thickly insulated with gold to withstand extreme heat and cold. The extraterrestrial rubbish collector had four cameras, radars, and lasers that would work out the speed, direction, and rotation of any disused satellite it would encounter. Finally, it was equipped with magnets that would capture the stray piece of debris. Having caught the piece of rubbish, the rubbish collector would then fly back with it to the edge of Earth's atmosphere, where they would both be burned up on re-entry. Scientists believe that humankind took one small but significant step towards the first extraterrestrial rubbish collection service. While this was just the first satellite of its kind, and was only able to destroy one piece of rubbish, scientists hope that within 10 years, they will have built a version that can capture up to four large pieces of debris at a time, drop them off in Earth's atmosphere to burn up, and then go back to pick up some more. Once the satellite has done all that it is programmed to do, it will self-destruct. The cost of such an operation could be met by satellite firms serious about cleaning up space or by national space agencies and governments. Every country that has a space agency that launches satellites should be responsible for clearing up their own debris. An international space organization has been specially created to try to solve the problem of rubbish in space. It is an advisory group that has been working with space agencies to find ways to safely bring down satellites at the end of their lives, so they do not present a threat to other functioning spacecraft which are currently in orbit. People from outside the scientific community are becoming aware of rubbish in space. The majority of people who rely on satellites for services like mobile phones or internet money transfers have no idea that the technology they depend on in modern life may not be able to continue in its present form. The problem of rubbish in space must be addressed urgently. Scientists agree that, like any environmental issue, if the problem of rubbish in space is ignored, it could get much worse. It would reach a point where finding a remedy would be much more difficult and expensive than simply preventing the problem from getting out of control. One leading scientist compared not removing satellites in space once they have stopped working to leaving cars that have broken down and left abandoned on the motorway, expecting other cars to just swerve round them. It is also like people crossing a very busy road, where there are no pedestrian lights to regulate the traffic, and having to dodge the cars.
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.